This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
This will be a rather boring, uninteresting, dry review of the laws of Pesach. And we're also not going to have any chavruta. I'm only saying that because if people wanted a more like Pardes-like learning experience, I think that's what Nechama is doing. So I don't want to mislead. As soon as this shiur starts, I'm going to go into dry halachic man voice. It's a monotone, and that's what it sounds like. So I hope we're all ready.
All I have time to do is sign you out, so I'm sorry.
Okay.
You know what? I think we're going to have to move your resume again as my pitchy person. Can we sign back in?
I mean, no. You can look at me every 10. No, you have to sign back in.
I need more chairs.
Okay, I'll give the people who ran out. Oh, she's still taping. That's awkward. Okay, everybody heard the warning, though, right?
Yeah.
I'll repeat the warning. This is not the goal of this is not to be particularly intellectually engaging, stimulating, or fascinating. This is a very practical run through. No, I'm not joking, really. So if you want like a more Pardes-like experience of interactive learning, Nechama is a better bet. In all seriousness, I'm really just going to try to cover the basics and then field people's questions about managing their apartments and whatever they want to kosher for Pesach and so on. That's really what I'm aiming for here. Okay? So the warning label is now firmly in place. It's like this product may contain nuts. Okay. This product may contain a lot of dry halachic detail. We're all good? Okay. Really?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we're going to start. And I think the way we're going to structure it... Well, first of all, could people throw out some questions of things that they need to know or they want to know so I have a sense of what people would like to have filled in for them? It could be as basic or as complex, if you like. If it's complex, I probably can't answer it. But can people just throw out some questions of things that they would very much like to make sure it's covered? Yes.
Covering.
Huh?
Covering.
Covering things.
To cover or not
yes.
To cover.
Everyone
that's
ever
the
see
question.
The place where people aluminum foil everything? It looks like a Star Trek movie?
Yes.
I love
yes.
that.
Yes.
Not usually so necessary, but we'll cover that. What's your name, by the way?
I'm Judith Phillips from Manchester.
Oh, nice to meet you. I was supposed to meet you. This is not what my teaching will be like there. Don't worry. I promise. I actually do know how to be somewhat interesting. Yeah.
The reality of having a roommate that follows different ways of handling themselves when they say
that. Fair enough. So let me put down covering and roommates. This is just for myself. If you can't read it, that's okay. What else? Yes.
The difference between what's the right to what's the rabbanan and what's mehag.
Okay, that's a good one. Sort of the different levels. That's helpful too. Yes.
Specific during the Seder, if there are specific things as the leader that you have to do.
Okay, the Seder. We'll talk about that. Yes.
Like how intensely do I have to caution the house? Like what feed product should I use?
Okay, intensity. I like that one. I'm not sure where that'll take us, but I like it. Really, like, what is the obligation versus what is the psychosis, right?
Right.
That's the basic thing we want to figure out. Okay, welcome. Would you be comfortable over here, sir? Will that work for you? Gabrielle, can you slide over a little bit? We're going to get you an empty seat. No, it's okay. Are you with this gentleman? So let's make room. Let's slide down a little bit so I can squeeze in another chair. My pleasure. Okay. You're okay with those chairs? That works for you? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
We often buy a lot of new stuff for Pesach, both utensils and new packets of food. What's the need for that?
What's the need for buying new stuff? other than wasting a lot of money, you're saying, which is also a positive commandment around Pesach time? Yes.
Any issues with having a non-Jew and a Seder?
Non-Jew and a Seder. I like that one too, yes.
Along with Harris's question, should we assume that chametz got into everything?
Should we assume that chametz, well, you know, on Pesach, right, there is a very strange thing that leavened foods become animate, they have a soul, and they're evil, and they try to infiltrate. So how this happens scientifically, I can't tell you, but that is what happens, and we have to be on our guard. Yes?
Like with the new stuff, like if you have a package of plastic silverware that was opened before Pesach, can you use that on Pesach? You have to buy new plastic silverware.
Okay.
Chametz got into it.
Chametz got into it. It attacked. I told you. The chametz is actually, what's the term of those little tiny robots? It's nanoscience. Chametz is governed by evil people with nanoscience, and they're controlling your breadcrumbs, everybody. Sorry to tell you. Okay. Let's start. Yes.
How about
kidneyote?
Yeah.
Kidneyote. That's a good one. Wow, there is what to talk about. Who knew? I thought we'd be done in 9 minutes. We could all get coffee. All right. Let's start with the Seder. Okay, and we'll move then to the prohibitions. Okay, let's begin with the Seder. The Seder actually is not that complicated, okay? And I'm going to break it down for you halachically, which will not cover, we'll talk a little bit about other ways to make it fun and interesting and enjoyable. So they say. I've never managed to do that, but in theory they say it's possible. There are two biblical commandments in the Seder night, okay? One of them is to tell the story. Quite literally, to tell the Higadta Levincha, to tell the story of leaving Egypt. And the rabbinic custom of that is to tell the story in question and answer form. So therefore, the Manishtana, the four questions, become the launching pad for telling the story. According to the rabbis, the way we tell that story, there are two things that go on. Number one, we take the verses from Deuteronomy, that short, like 6 or 8 Psukim, they're like this national history of the Jewish people, right? It starts with Arameo Vedavi, my father was a wandering Aramean, or as the rabbis translated, an Aramean, i.e. Lavan, tried to destroy my father Jacob. And in about 6 or 7 sentences, it says, we ended up down in Egypt, and then God took us out with signs and wonders, and then he brought us out, and the text finishes with bring us to the land of Israel, which did not make it into our Haggadah, interestingly enough. And those... that becomes the frame. Now, in its initial context in the Bible, those were the verses that one recited when they brought Bikurim. When you brought the first fruits to the temple, this was like the short national history that every Jew was supposed to know, right? The basic 8 sentences of, my forefathers did this, we were slaves in Egypt, God took us out, he brought us to this land, and now this fruit is my way of saying thank you because everything I have was given to me by God. That short 8 sentences became the frame that the Chazal say, the rabbis say we use, but they all say we should darshan it. We do drashot, which is why, if you notice in the body of the Haggadah, it'll read that pasuk, there'll be midrashim on each word. That's all that's going on there. The four sons and a lot of other stuff are all things that got added in, which is why, by the way, you should feel free to add in any kind of readings or other things that are relevant to you. You don't have to only stick with the script. Okay, that's one mitzvah to tell the story. We also say we tell the story with props. And the props basically appear on our Seder plate. Right? That's where you have the bitter herbs, and that's where you have the roasted egg and the roasted shank bone, and that's where you have your matzah and so on. Because the Seder plate originally was your dinner plate. Okay, in the times of the rabbis, the Seder plate was your dinner plate, and the two cooked foods are the foods you actually ate as your Seder meal. Now they become much more symbolic, but that's really the role of the Seder plate. We tell the story with the props in front of us, and that's one biblical command. The other one is to eat matzah. Matzah on the Seder night is biblical, and therefore we have to eat matzah. Now we eat matzah twice at the Seder. We eat it both at when the food portion begins, right? We make hamotzi, we make the blessing of al achilat matzah, and at that point, everyone is supposed to eat a minimum of one kazayit, right? And ideally, two kazayits, one for motzi and one for matzah. That became the medieval custom. The big debate, of course, is how much is a kazayit? How much is the minimum requirement someone has to ingest? I will tell you a couple things about that. It ranges everything from two-thirds of a whole hand shmura matzah all the way down to one-third of machine matzah. Okay? So here's the artist's rendition of that. It's everything of something that big to something this big. I recommend you, and some would say even less, that a kazayit is the size of your hand. That's the smallest one I've seen. I strongly recommend two things. First, adopt a practice that works for you. I happen to like matzah, and as you can tell, I like eating, so ingesting. Folks that listening at home, it's because I'm heavily overweight, in case you didn't know. So I've lost a lot of weight recently, though, so hopefully it's a good trend. So therefore, if it's comfortable for you, there's no problem in eating, right? If you like eating matzah, but if it's troubling for you, go with the smaller amount. Don't make yourself sick. Now, the custom also is to eat this matzah while leaning, right? Originally, in rabbinic times, it was really reclining. They ate on these feasting couches, which looks good to me. Today, we don't really have that practice, but a lot of people put a pillow, and you lean to your left when you ingest this matzah. The other time you eat matzah is for the afikomen. The afikomen, this is the matzah that no one looks forward to. It comes at the end of the meal. It's the last thing you eat before Birkat HaMazon. And you eat the afikomen, again, two kazeitim ideally, one for matzah and one to symbolize the paschal lamb. The paschal sacrifice in biblical times was consumed towards the end of the meal because you were supposed to eat it when you were already somewhat full and not ravenously hungry. And therefore, the afikomen, which is probably a Greek word for dessert, okay, is when we also pass around the matzah. Now, the matzah on Pesach, a very important guest walked in for those following at home. You need a chair, though. Here you go. This is Rabbi Jordan Safra, everyone. The matzah, however, you may have heard the term shmura matzah. Are people familiar with that term? Okay. Shmura matzah, so I'm going to explain, means two things. First of all, it means that the wheat was guarded from the time it was harvested. Typically, right, in order to avoid chametz, matzah only has to be guarded from the time that it was ground. Okay? Into flour. And according to some opinions, even after it's flour. But we're not going to go there. We don't hold that way. Shmura matzah, meaning guarded matzah, was watched from the time that it was already harvested. Some people, like Maimonides and others, have the custom of eating only shmura matzah for all of Pesach. However, the reason we're careful to have shmura matzah on the Seder is because shmura matzah is also made l'shem mitzvah, for the purpose of the commandment. In order to fulfill the requirement of matzah on the Seder night, we need to ingest matzah that was made for the purpose of fulfilling the commandment. Okay? So shmura matzah fits that bill. So even if one eats regular matzah during Pesach, many say it's important to have shmura matzah at least for the ritual eating of matzah at your Seder. Okay? So many people will have either the hand shmura or the machine shmura, and it's marked as such. All hand matzah is shmura matzah. Machine matzah comes in two varieties. The shmur matzah is about four times the price. That's how you'll know. I tell you the truth, because the flour is more expensive because it's been harvested and guarded specially. Now, you will also find many Hasidim only eat the hand shmur. Okay? Are we okay with matzah? We're ready to move on from matzah? Okay. The rabbinic commandments of the evening... Bitter herbs, maror, is a rabbinic commandment. It appears twice. There is a commandment, we eat the maror on its own. Typically, now Ashkenazim have a long custom of using horseradish. If one uses horseradish, it should not be horseradish that's had sugar or vinegar or anything, not the stuff you put on your gefilte fish, but it should be the root itself.
Okay, so so not eating with just beet juice.
Right. Nothing added because beet juice sweetens it and takes away the bitter flavor. I personally find that horseradish root very hard to ingest, so it's very common not to use lettuce. Basically, any lettuce will work. Most people seem to use romaine lettuce. You can either use the whole leaf or you could just use the stalks, you know, the center spine. Again, you're supposed to have a kazait. For our purposes, an average, decent-sized romaine lettuce leaf is a kazait. Okay? You can either use the principle of the size of your hand, or you can just take one leaf. We don't eat that leaning because it's not a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of slavery. We ingest that leaf after making the blessing, and we're all happy. If you're going to use the horseradish root, I think it should fill like a shot glass. Some people mix in a little of the horseradish root into the lettuce. You could do that too. But halakhically speaking, my understanding is lettuce is preferable and much easier to eat than that stuff that... Because remember, bitter doesn't mean burning hot, right? Bitter means bitter. I mean this. Like, it doesn't mean harif. Mar and harif are different flavors. And for most of us, that straight horseradish root is a little hard to ingest. The other time that... Maror appears, of course, is in Korech, where we make a sandwich out of matzah and maror. Now, I should have mentioned, before we eat the maror, we have a custom of dipping it into the charoset. People familiar with charoset? Yes? Now, I realize we all have different customs. Halakhically speaking, one is not supposed to ingest the charoset with the maror, but rather just dip it in and then shake it off. It's done there, according to the Gemara, to kill the worms that might be in the lettuce. I know that's appetizing for all of us, but that's the reason that's given. But the reason we're not supposed to eat the charoset with the maror is because then we won't taste the maror. Now, when we come to the korech, or the hillel sandwich, which in my opinion is about the worst sandwich I've ever had in my entire life, the hillel sandwich is there because originally the biblical custom was to eat the matzah, the maror, and the paschal sacrifice, the lamb, all at one time. That actually sounds good. And by the way, the fact that they ate it all at one time proves to you that the original custom was to use soft matzah. Because there ain't no way to make a proper sandwich with matzah. Right? So, in commemoration of that, we take maror, and we take matzah, and we eat it as a sandwich. Again, the same, at least preferably, 2 kazaitim rule for the matzah, 1 kazait for the maror. And again, in my family, many people ate it with charoset. That custom does exist. The Shulchan Aruch again says eat it without the charoset. It's up to you. I want to pause and say one really important piece of advice. Ready for this one? Eyes on your own plate. Okay? One of the worst things we can do to one another at a Seder is give disapproving looks or unsolicited advice about how much matzah or maror someone should be eating. Okay? And I'm being very serious about this. If somebody asks you and they say, oh, I see you're taking this much matzah, you explain to me why, or I don't know how much to take, could you show me? Of course you can share that information. But very little will make somebody feel more uncomfortable than a judgmental look or glance or being told, hey, you didn't have enough of that. I really don't recommend that. Okay? If you're not asked, I strongly recommend you don't volunteer. Okay? Because it can create much more bad feeling than anything positive. It's your call, but that's my experience when I was a younger zealot and learned through difficult experience that doesn't help anyone or anything. So now I only torture my own children and nobody else's. And even them, my wife doesn't let me torture anymore. So, okay. The other rabbinic command of the Seder night is the 4 cups. Right? We drink 4 cups of wine. I rarely give halachic opinions. I'll give this one. Grape juice is just fine. I know many of you heard it has to be wine, preferably wine. In my humble opinion, grape juice is absolutely fine, especially if you don't want to drink that much wine. Now, ideally, each cup should hold a revi'it, which is a quarter lug, which I know will explain a lot to you. there are a range of opinions, okay? Anything from 3.3 to over 5 ounces, okay? And ideally, one drink, that's the size of the cup, And ideally, one drinks half of that cup. Now, because you're supposed to drink at least a little bit more than half the cup, I strongly recommend don't use a water glass as your wine glass at the Seder. But rather, find a Kiddush cup that is much smaller and manageable, and you find you won't be hammered by the time matzah comes out. Unless you want to be, which can also ease out the whole Seder a little bit. But that's totally up to you. Yeah.
Is Korech a Drabanan?
Yes, Korech is a Drabanan, or Minhag. Okay. Right, because you've already eaten the matzah and you've already had the maror. So it might be a Drabanan. We don't make a bracha over it. But you can either Drabanan or Minhag. That's a debate. Other questions? And the four cups, right, you can tell they sort of form the logic of the Seder. Cup number one is Kiddush. Cup number two is the over the blessing that we say at the end of reciting the Haggadah. It's a blessing of Geulah, of redemption. It's a very beautiful blessing. Cup number three is over Birkat HaMazon. Some of us know that the custom used to be to say Birkat HaMazon over a cup of wine. And cup number four is said at the end of the recitation of Hallel, at the end of the Seder. Four cups. Those, again, are consumed while leaning. There's also a nice custom that everybody fills a cup for somebody else, so everyone feels served. It's not essential, but that's the custom. They also make less alcoholic wines. For those who want to use wine, they make wines that are 5% alcohol as opposed to 9 or 12. So for people who don't want to have too much alcohol early on, that could be helpful also. The custom also is not to drink any wine between cup one and cup two. Okay? Or between cup three and cup four. Meaning, if you want to drink more wine with your meal, that's fine. That's during the meal. Otherwise, other than water, you're not supposed to be ingesting other beverages other than the wine. Okay? Questions about the four cups? Yes?
I thought it was just between three and four that you can't drink.
I think between one and two, you're not supposed to have wine. I think you have water, but I don't think you have wine. You can also eat. But I don't think you're supposed to have more wine. Most people don't really want to have more wine at that point. But I will check for you. So, yes?
So for the cup size for the wine,
yeah.
So if you have like a 4-ounce cup, so you need to drink like 2.1
right.
ounces.
Right. Look, some people say preferably you drink the whole cup. So, you know, for me, 4 ounces of wine is not a lot of wine. I can drink that, no problem. For some people, it's a lot, and I think that's why people have to do what's comfortable and what works for them. But 2.5 ounces of wine is not a lot of wine. If you think of an average wine glass, I think holds 6 ounces of wine. So you're looking at a little bit more than a third of a cup, and that's usually very manageable. You also don't have to drink it in one shot. You can sip it, you know, as long as you keep sipping, and you get to the end. Yeah.
So can you clarify soda and juice?
During the meal.
Okay, so, but not
in between the cups. As far as I understand, whether that's only true between 3 and 4 or also 1 and 2, I will check. But water is certainly okay. There's also a custom not to eat after the Seder is over, that after the Afikoman we don't eat anymore. Most people don't want to eat anymore, but that's besides the point. Okay? Any other questions about the Seder before we move on to our arch enemy, Chametz? Any other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned eating or drinking during that. Is that that's totally
look, in principle, here's the issue. Once you have karpas, right, you've made kiddush, so now you can eat, right? The issue is you're going to have this karpas, right? So the karpas, right, that we dip the vegetable, it's like one of the first things we do. We dip a vegetable in salt water. By the way, any vegetable will do, and any liquid will do. If you want to do bananas and maple syrup, you can do that. Mm. Some people like that. My kids like french fries into ketchup.
What about the salt water?
They like salt and ketchup. French fries into ketchup works very well. Yeah, people do have a custom. The custom used to be vinegar. Some people also salt water because of the tears. That's all custom. You know, dip what's comfortable for you. The thing that you will find, there is a debate, which I'm not going to get into because it gets very complicated, whether you can have a kazayit or you must have less than a kazayit. The problem is, I'll say it to you briefly, is if you have a kazayit in principle, you would have to make a blessing after you ate. And then that will interrupt the eating of the the borei priha adama that you made, which is also supposed to cover your maror. You see how the sardin around this problem Ashkenazim do. So therefore, the custom emerged to have less than a kazayit, but not everybody does. Some people keep a vegetable platter out and they eat vegetables throughout because people get hungry and crabby. Yeah.
So if you like serve at, like appetizers immediately after karpas, as long as like people are continuously eating them, then it's fine.
That depends. I mean, the average custom is people aren't going to do that, but some people can. You know, if you want, some people do keep out a vegetable tray, or when my kids were younger, a pile of French fries that people would just keep noshing on all the way through. In principle, one could do that. Yeah, it's just up to you. I'm just saying the normative practice seems to be to have only a little bit, and something like parsley, which really tastes awful and doesn't help you get full at all, and you dip that in salt water, very exciting, and then you fry until the meal comes. Yeah.
Hard-boiled eggs
is just a custom, okay? A lot of people serve that after the matzah and the maror. All custom, you don't have to have a hard-boiled egg. Some people actually put hard-boiled egg and potato in salt water and make it into a kind of soup. That's my wife's family's custom. Okay? I'm sorry, if people like that, delicious. But all that stuff, all that eating is all just celebratory Yom Tov eating. And you can serve whatever foods that you're interested in. Yeah.
Just to be sure, you say that karpas is a rabbinical?
Yes. Yeah, karpas is not even with it. It's more minna. We do it in order, according to the Talmud, to raise questions. Okay? Now, the only limitation on what you can serve, we have the custom of not serving roasted meat. Because people might get confused and think it's the Paschal sacrifice. Some people even extend that to roasted chicken, believe it or not. That's up to you. But anything cooked in any kind of sauce is not roasted. Is that clear? So if you want to serve brisket or anything else, if it's in any kind of liquid, then it's not considered roasted anymore. But that is the practice that people don't have roasted meats on Pesach night. Anything else? Yes?
Sorry, in my family is Muslim, they used to put this part of the chicken. It's good. We don't need.
Oh, I think any... Look, the truth is, for the Seder plate, you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You can use anything. You know, the custom seems to be to use a roasted egg and a roasted something else. Some people use the chicken wing. Some people actually buy a shank bone if they can find it. It's purely symbolic. We don't eat it. It's there to symbolize the Paschal sacrifice and the festival sacrifice that used to be brought. Its initial reason for being there is those are the two cooked foods that you ate. It morphed in the Middle Ages into symbolizing the sacrifices that aren't there, but you can use the neck, whatever you want. Yeah?
Question regarding the eating of the first matzah and the leaning.
Yeah.
I understood that it was kind of a symbol of freedom.
It is.
Okay, what we heard from Tova Dea, she made the meditation where she eats the matzah and closes her eyes and does the different steps. I understood more that it was the first matzah when you try to connect more with something. The poor character of the matzah and not the fast or.
Look, matzah is very odd because biblically it's both a symbol of slavery and it's a symbol of freedom all at the same time. It's this dual food because it commemorates both, according to one biblical passage, it's the bread that we ate as slaves in Egypt, right? That's how we begin, right? Ha lachma'anya, look at this poor bread that our forefathers ate as slaves. And it's also the bread that we say that reminds us when we were taken out of Egypt, we didn't have time to let the dough rise. So matzah serves both of those functions. It's very odd in that way.
So we should lean.
You don't lean back and forth. You never lean to your right. According to the rabbis, it's dangerous to lean to your right because of your esophagus and trachea, and they're right about that. If you're eating in bed, lean on your left side. Never eat on your right. I think it's right. So there. I have no idea. Anyways, you always lean to your left. The only thing you don't lean for is maror. You lean for matzah, you lean for korech, and you lean when you drink the wine. All four cups. No, according to most opinions, if you don't lean, you have not fulfilled the requirement of the mitzvah.
Yes.
Most opinions would say you have to drink the four cups again if you did not lean while drinking them.
Did you just say again, you lean for which?
You lean for matzah, you lean for korech, the sandwich, right? And you lean for all four cups of wine. We do not lean for Mara. Any questions before we go on to our friend Cummings?
Non-Jews at the Seder.
Non-Jews at the Seder, thank you. Oh, I actually did make a list for some reason or other. Look at that.
It looks like
non-Jews at the Seder should not be consumed until one is made kiddush. That was wildly inappropriate. Please take that out. That's what happens. In the Middle Ages, believe it or not, some people felt it was especially meritorious to invite non-Jews to your Seder so they could see that the matzah and the wine are completely blood-free. And I'm not making that up. There's a tshuva of the Maharil, 15th century rabbi, who says exactly that. The only issue, there's no problem with having non-Jews in your Seder. There's only one issue, right? And that's the issue of wine. If you are using, and again, I am not, it's a complicated discussion. If you are using wines that are not mevushal, that have not been cooked, in principle, even though it's not 100% clear, but I have a different source sheet on that, if a non-Jew pours from the bottle, no one else can drink that wine. So the standard advice is if you're having non-Jews at your Seder, to make sure you have mevushal wine or grape juice. Okay? The reason some people don't like this, Maimonides seems to think that you need non-mevushal wine for Kiddush or for the Dal Kosov, the four cups. We don't really paskin that way. So that would be sort of the standard piece of advice. The other potential problem is even though we can cook on Chag, we can't cook for non-Jews on Chag. So if you are, you know, heating up water, which most people don't do, but in principle, you couldn't heat it up only for the non-Jew at your table. I've never seen that issue come up, but that's not a theoretical problem. Yes, that was what you wanted me to cover? Okay, look at that. Pardes covers or Kovave covers? Oh, another bad thing to say.
You said you couldn't heat up the water just for the non-Jew?
Right, but if you're heating up for everyone, it's not a problem. That's correct.
Is this the same with the food then?
Yeah.
Okay. So if like a non-Jew says, I want a cup of tea, you gotta make enough for like a lot of people.
Well, you just have to make, if you're making for a few people, it's fine, but you wouldn't be able to heat up water just for them. But because we use kumkums, urns, and everything else, it almost never comes out. Okay? Those are the only issues I can think of. Other than that, I think it's a very nice idea, especially if those non-Jews happen to be family members or close friends. There's no reason not to include them. And I think that, you know, I know that some people have this idea like it's our thing and not their thing. I don't think there's any reason to subscribe to that. There's no halachic problem with having non-Jews at your Seder. And especially for those of us who have non-Jews in our family, including me, there's no reason not to invite and include. If they want to come or if they're comfortable or not, that's a separate discussion, but there's no halachic obstacle to that. Are we ready to go on to chametz?
Yeah.
Yes? Okay. So.
How much are you starting to
cost? Very much so. So, the issue with chametz is as follows. Chametz is tricky. Well, first of all, what is chametz? Chametz is any of the five grains, right? Wheat, barley, rye, oats, and what's the last one?
Spelt.
Huh? Spelt. Thank you. Other than that, any of those five grains that have been, as flour, have been exposed to water for more than 18 minutes. Okay? That's the technical definition of chametz. By the way, it's also true that matzah can only be made from one of those fine grains. Matzah and chametz are, right, these interestingly related things. Only those five grains. Kidney oat, legumes are not chametz. In Ashkenaz, they took on the practice of not eating legumes. There are different reasons given, either because the legumes were put in the same sacks with wheat and other chametz-type things, or because the fear that you could make flour out of the legumes and therefore people get confused. Whatever the reason, kidney oat, which Ashkenazic Jews have avoided for, you know, probably 800 years or so, okay, it's a long-standing custom, they are not chametz, which means they do not render your dishes or silverware or anything in your kitchen unkosher for Pesach. Okay? If you are roommates with a Sephardic Jew, they can cook rice in your Pesach pot, and as long as you wash it, you can also then cook your Pesach food in that pot. Same thing with microwaves, same thing with ovens. They do not render your dishes or utensils unfit for Passover. They are not chametz. Which means if you are invited to a Seder of a Sephardic family and your custom is not to eat the kidney oat, you can attend. Just don't eat the kidney oat. Right? And I've had hummus on matzah and it's not great. Truth is truth. Unless it's the soft matzah, which Ashkenazim also don't eat. The shorthand is Ashkenazim ruin Passover. Thank you very much. Okay? But that's the extent of kidney oat. I will say that it is a long-standing minhag. I have respect for the minhag. I don't think people will starve without legumes. So I think people view this at either two extremes, right? One extreme is they view kidney oat as chametz, and then they want to blow up the rice factory down the block. The other is people walk around bitter and angry. How come they get to eat Doritos on Pesach and I don't get to eat them? I think both those extremes are extreme. Kidney oat are not, I'll talk about derivatives in a moment, kidney oat are not chametz. At the same time, I don't think it's a terrible hardship to not eat beans, rice, or corn for a week either. So I think we can go to either end, but what you practice is yours. Yes?
Can I just clarify something? So say if I'm going kosher and Pesach before Shabbat HaGadol, which I intend to.
You can cook kidney oat
and
in your Pesach dishes.
I want to make rice for Shabbat.
No problem.
I can cook the rice in my Pesach pot.
Yes, you can.
Rinse it out. I don't have to have a separate pot.
That's correct.
Thank you.
My pleasure. You will find someone in your community, though, who will excommunicate you and not eat your
own. That's why I'm here. Oh.
I should have mentioned that. I want to be very clear. What people do and what I am saying may have nothing to do with each other, and I strongly advise don't get into a debate with somebody about it. The worst thing you can do is try to debate with somebody why what you're doing is okay, and they can still, you know, whatever people are doing, they're going to do. Don't have that debate. If you want to host somebody and they have all these issues and you just want to host them, so host them. You know, you can deal with their neuroses, and that's okay too. You know, so you may, don't tell them you made the rice. Whatever it needs to happen, right? Because people do have very strong personal feelings about this. Kidney oil, kidney oat. Okay, so for a long time it was a debate. Some people used oils made from kidney oat, arguing that none of the reasons of the minhag would apply. Others, however, said no. Even shemen kidney oat. Oils from kidney oat are prohibited. Surprise of surprise, the standard practice today is to be stringent, and most people don't use kidney oat oils. The other thing that happened is new foods. Can there be new kidney oat? For example, when quinoa was discovered, or canola oil, right? Now, canola oil was not kidney oat, or peanut oil, or peanuts for that matter. That was a debate for a while. Rav Moshe Feinstein famously allowed peanuts for Pesach. However, Baruch Hashem, we all became very stringent. And peanuts, there used to be OU, kosher Passover peanut oil. That hasn't been true for about 35, 40 years because we want to make sure to fulfill the commandment of spending as much money as we can on oil for Passover. Canola oil, which until 5 or 6 years ago the Rabbanut allowed. Now canola oil is kidney oat. I will confess, I ingest canola oil as a beverage on Pesach. The palm oil that is most commonly found here looks awful. It like congeals in the bottle, so I imagine that's what it's doing in my arteries as well. You can also find here walnut oil, which, you know, if you want to mortgage your house, you can buy. And if you really want to spend a lot of money, you can get grapeseed oil here. But palm oil is the most common Ashkenazic alternative. Yeah.
Recently, coconut oil has become more popular in America, but it doesn't need kosher Pesach, but it has to be like very stringent hechsher specifically during Pesach.
Could be. I don't even use coconut oil during the year, so I don't know. But it's certainly not kidney oil.
Yeah, and would it be okay here?
You'd have to check. Everything here that's okay for Pesach is marked. So you can look and you can see. Yeah.
Let's say you do use canola oil, but you have a bottle like before Pesach starts.
Okay.
That hasn't been opened.
So
that's the same as like any other food.
Okay. Food. So because chametz is the only thing that's prohibited, b'mashehu, which means even the slightest bit of chametz cannot be ingested on Pesach. That stringency, which goes back to the Talmud, by the way, is why people became crazy about chametz. Because generally, prohibited foods become nullified if there's a crumb or a little bit of them. Chametz is the exception. Therefore, many people have the custom of only using things that have been newly opened for Pesach because of this fear that maybe when you were cooking, a crumb or two fell in. That happens to be the common practice. Does that mean if you used an open bottle of canola oil, you should throw out your food? I would say no. I'm just telling you, you will find that people will tend to open up new things. And that also is why they will look for things that are hechshered for Pesach, even though there's no chametz in them, like tuna, or milk, or cottage cheese, or all these things that have no chametz in them, but for Pesach they like to be stringent, and therefore only use those new things that are marked. In Israel, all those things are marked anyways, the cheese, the yogurt, everything else. Yogurts, however, many of them have kitniot in them. Okay, in my humble opinion, by the way, kitniot is nullified by a majority. So in principle, all yogurts would be kosher for Pesach, including the Sephardic yogurts. I will tell you, though, most Ashkenazic Jews won't do that, and they will only buy the yogurts that are marked kosher for Pesach for without kitniot. And it's marked that way. Anything that has kitniot in this country is marked with kitniot. Yeah?
Regarding nullification, in terms of Betty Kahn, I thought nullifies any of those.
No, you can't ingest it. That's to avoid the prohibition of owning, right? There's a separate prohibition on Pesach. Not only can we not eat chametz, we can't own chametz. Okay? So that is why people do one of two things. Either they consume it all before Pesach, or if they have chametz they don't want to throw out, we have this custom of selling one's chametz. It is a halachic fiction, if you will, where our chametz is sold, all the chametz of Israel is sold to this one Arab guy who lives in Abu Ghosh, by the way. And in America, I don't know how they do it. I think it's by each community. And the chametz is sold. So during Pesach, it belongs to that person, and you can't use it, or it shouldn't even be accessible to you. Now, people have different thoughts on this. I don't think it pays to sell chametz for one pita or one slice of bread. It makes a lot of sense why people sell chametz if they have fancy scotch or things that they don't want to get rid of. Everything in between is up to you. I will say this. Selling chametz is a time-honored tradition, regardless of the halachic challenges of it. And Jews have been doing it for centuries. And therefore, even if you don't sell, it's not a problem if somebody else does. The one area where this gets interesting is if one has not sold their chametz, that chametz cannot be eaten after Passover. Which is why, if it was owned by a Jew, which is why the supermarkets in Israel are all careful to sell their chametz before Pesach, so you can buy the cereal as soon as Pesach is over. However, in certain instances where the chametz is owned by a Jew who did not sell his chametz, the common example is you are visiting a friend who did not sell their chametz and they offer you some very good scotch, you have a problem. Because if they didn't sell it, then it's literally chametz that remained in their possession through Pesach.
How do you approach that conversation? If he's like, you want some scotch? Like, yeah. And then you sit down and it's like, well, actually, before you pour, like, and then it just awkward.
I understand. I don't have an easy answer. Like with everything else, have the conversation before the scotch is offered. Right? In other words, the worst thing to do is like to show up at somebody's house and say, by the way, I'm a vegan who doesn't eat anything processed. Right? If you're a vegan who doesn't eat any processed food, that's wonderful. Tell your host, well, probably 3 weeks in advance, tell your host before, and I would say the same thing here. If you have concerns, but you want to accept an invitation, have an open, honest conversation that's not judgmental, right? Don't start off with, by the way, I want to know, are you a sinner who doesn't sell their chametz before Pesach? But put it on you. Say, listen, I don't know if you're aware of this. I have certain practices I follow. This is one of them. Will this create a problem for you?
This is like the next December.
I think if they, any good scotch that would not be around for that many months. I think you can assume they're already on the next bottle. That's what I would assume. It's a long time between now and December.
So you said you do eat canola oil. Is that what you're using in your family?
Well, see, we go away. I have a gig as a rabbi at this nice place up north, so I eat whatever they put in front of me. But that place probably doesn't. But yes, when we made Pesach at home, I used canola oil proudly.
So the other thing, it's very confusing here in Israel. In America, it was like O-U-P, and
right.
You know that was the symbol.
Correct.
Here, there are all these abbreviations, like you were saying, lolo, like kidney,
correct.
La, 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 whatever.
Right.
You don't even know what they look like.
Right. So lolo, all you need if you're not eating kidney oat is to see that it's lolo ochle kidney.
Yeah, but it's also an abbreviation for that.
Oh.
Lamed, lamed.
It could be. I don't know.
I've never seen the abbreviation.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, something like that.
Many places, like Rami Levy, for example, will put the kidney oat yogurts in one section and the naan in another. So that is often very, very helpful. But again, as I told you, just between us, kidney oat and yogurts aren't really prohibited in any event. But, okay, just in case, that's what people want to do. Yes?
And that's because the kidney oat would be a small proportion.
You got it. It's less than half.
What's the kidney oat that's in there?
I think it's often like probably like a corn sweetener, it might be, or other oil, or thickening agents that are made from some kind of oil. I really don't know. It better be, because otherwise that's a disgusting yogurt. Good God. Yeah, that would be the theory. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So I can put my kidney at home and don't have to sell anything.
Ah, kidney do not need to be sold or gotten rid of. Don't throw out your rice or your beans or any of those things. You may own them and keep them. Just don't eat them on Pesach if that's your practice. So a lot of people do is they'll either leave it on a cabinet, it'll be marked kidney oat, or leave it in a bag. It can stay in your fridge, right? It's all fine. Don't throw it out. People have this impulse to throw out all the food in their home. You don't need to throw out your canned corn, your canned peas. None of that has to be thrown out. If your custom is not to eat it, don't eat it. But there's no prohibition in owning kidney oat on Pesach. None, zero. Don't throw out food. Okay? Please. And the open thing of canola oil, if you're not going to use canola or corn oil, you don't have to throw it out. Just put it aside.
I mean, I use it, but I was just asking, like, in general, if I have...
I understand. That would be the process. Okay. Let's go on to, yes.
In America, we had to buy certain things before Pesach, like eggs and milk and yogurt. Does that apply here?
Not really. That's only done. That's like a stringency that in case a crumb fell into the milk, betul nullification works before Pesach, according to many opinions. You don't need to do that. Here, people used to buy milk and freeze it. All the milk here is labeled kosher to Pesach. No one's eating sandwiches in the dairy vat. You're fine. There's no reason to do that.
I think, yeah.
If you want to, you can, but there's no reason. All the dairy goods already are marked kosher to Pesach here. So even if you wanted to buy milk that wasn't kosher to Pesach and freeze it, you'd have had to do it a week ago. All this stuff now, I think the last 2 weeks probably, has all been labeled kosher to Pesach. Yeah.
For Ashkenazi that decide are in this country and are eating out in restaurants, how do you keep a lookout for
The Tu'udah will say most restaurants are kidney oat included, unless you know otherwise. The average restaurant here is with kidney oat. And that's true, and you just have to, they will tell you if you ask. And you'll know by the menu. A little more complicated, because if the oil is kidney oat, then it's in everything, I think, but you know that's your call. But your average restaurant here is ochle kidney oat. Your average hotel is probably not. So then you have to sort of figure that out for yourself. Okay, let's talk about koshering. Yes? To be honest with you, I can't really imagine why you couldn't use it. I will also, of course, tell you, are there people who say, of course you can't use it? Yes. If you're really worried, I guess you could rinse it off, right? Because if you rinse it off, even if there was a crumb there, it would be gone. But again, the flip side way of looking at it is, if I'm going to use it all anyways, I'm going to buy another package in a month, it doesn't hurt to buy a new package if it makes everybody comfortable because it'll all get used. But halachically speaking, it would be hard to imagine why. Okay, let's talk about kashering. The issue with chametz is not only the crumbs and the bread and everything else, but according to the laws of kashrut, the flavor of something is transferred through heat, which means when you cook oatmeal in a pot, that pot is then said to have absorbed the flavor of chametz. Therefore, anything cooked subsequently in that pot will render that food chametz. You see where this is going. Because of that, we cannot use the pots and silverware that we use during the year, because the assumption is all of it is chametz, because it is all absorbed through heat, the flavor of chametz. So we have two options. We can either buy new, which is not an unreasonable investment if you're going to make Pesach every year. Saves you a lot of time. Or you can kosher things. We kosher things by exposing them to the same heat that they got when they absorbed the original flavor in the first place, which means a pot of oatmeal that absorbed through boiling liquid, the way you would kosher that pot is to immerse it in a larger pot of boiling liquid, which is why you will see in Jerusalem at various corners and centers these massive Macbethian cauldrons of boiling hot water. And for a fee, you can bring your pots there, as long as they've been cleaned, and they will dip them for you and kosher them for you. But it's a pain. Same thing for silverware, same thing for things like that. There are a few things that are not kosherable. Technically, anything that has been absorbed direct from the dough, like a baking sheet, cannot be koshered for Pesach. But your standard pots and pans, silverware, knives, all things like that, can indeed be kosher for Passover, as long as you can get them clean. And people do that. A lot of people these days don't, but that used to be the standard practice. The other thing that's not kosherable are ceramics. Ceramics, according to halacha, are not kosherable. Therefore, glazed china is preferably not kosherable.
But I brought all my china here.
I don't blame you, but you should have been using it all Shabbat. But so glazed pottery, glazed mugs and things like that, we preferably do not try to kosher them for Passover. If you have an issue, come talk to me. Yeah.
So if you're boiling a pot in a bigger pot, the bigger pot has to be koshered too, no?
Well,
or no?
If it's clean and hasn't been used for 24 hours, yeah, I mean, preferably the bigger pot also can't be a chametz pot. That's true. So you need a koshering pot for Pesach. But what you can do is you can kosher that pot. You do that by taking a big pot, filling it with boiling water. This is the real safe part. And then you take a hot rock or brick that you've heated in your oven and drop that in the pot and cause it to overflow.
Only after you've koshered your oven.
Well, this is beautiful. Well, I don't know. That's how you would kosher a big pot. Yes, you could also get it, but you could get a new big pot. But I think for the same money, you could just get two small pots and use that for Pesach and one small frying pan and call it a day. By the way, frying pans also are not kosherable for the same reason, because the type of direct blowtorch type heat they would need will kill the pan. So technically they're kosherable, but only after they become a lump of metal.
Cool.
But frying pans are not kosherable for that reason. Yeah.
Sorry, going back to something earlier, but I just remembered, and it's a topic that's very close to our heart. What about coffee? And I've heard some people say it's like, if you have it from the beans, then it's like, it's a bean.
So Starbucks beans are OU for Passover, if that helps. You know, it all depends. I imagine the coffee mill, if you're just buying the straight beans, I would imagine that there's no problem using those beans for Pesach. The issue is, how about your grinder? Did you use your grinder for anything else? Was it in your kitchen? At the end of the day, you can really do it. It just becomes like this psychological hurdle. And remember the slavery in Egypt. You can drink instant. By the way, how are we doing energy-wise? Are we okay? All right.
Glass.
Glass. Our Sephardic friends treat glass as something that never absorbs anything, and therefore they will wash their glasses and use them for Passover. Ashkenazic Jewry is strict with glass, minimally on Pesach. Whether during the year or not is a debate, but on Pesach our custom is not to use glass unless it has been koshered. The way we kosher glass is we soak it in water, changing the water once every day for 3 days. I want to point out one other thing. Sticking something in dirt does not kosher it. I know we all have stories of grandma sticking the knives in the dirt. Sticking something in dirt kosher is nothing. Okay? Koshering has to happen through heat. The reason we stick knives in dirt is because if a knife was used in cutting something cold, the rabbis felt that the an unkosher piece of meat, that the fat from the meat was very hard to remove. Remember, it's back in the day, they had no cleaning products, right? So the way one could clean a knife thoroughly was to jam it inside dirt or sand a number of times to remove the schmutz. It doesn't accomplish anything to be used hot. The only way to kosher something that was exposed through heat is with heat, which is why the oven, now that I can come to the oven, an oven is koshered on Pesach first. You have to clean the oven to remove any of the leftover chametz that might be in there, even though it's all burnt up, but I know it's not there, but you clean the oven anyways, and then you are supposed to turn the oven on to its highest heat for about a half hour. If you have a self-cleaning oven, you just put it on clean and you're done. It is preferable to clean the oven door, though, the part that's not inside, and to clean around the oven to remove any residue that might be there. Okay? It's not complicated. I will tell you, some people are stringent with ovens, and they won't use an oven no matter what for Pesach, unless it's a self-cleaning oven. I'm just preparing you. Most of those people will be satisfied if you double wrap your stuff before you cook it. But I'm just warning you, there are folks out there like that. In the Haredi world, they use a lot of these wonder pots, which you put on top of the... You know what I'm talking about? They're like these special pots that you can put on the burner, and they're supposed to function like an oven. Either way, I'm just letting you know that exists out there. Steph?
So like plastic, you can't... So
Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks plastic is kosherable. You can immerse it in boiling water. Having said that, you will find people who say it's not kosherable.
So if my knives or pots or stuff have plastic pots to them?
That's okay. If you can remove the plastic handles, that's better. If not, clean them out, and when they're boiled, you're okay.
Just one question about the oven. Do you have to leave it for 24 hours?
Yes, preferably you don't use it for anything you're koshering.
24 hours before cleaning.
Yes, cleaning less so. No heat contact for 24 hours. Well, you would have to clean it, I guess, in any event, right? Between the time it's going to be kosher and the last time you used it.
24 hours.
Meaning, if you want to kosher a pot, you should not use that pot. You should clean it and then not use it for 24 hours before koshering. The reason is because after 24 hours, the flavor that's emitted is a negative flavor and technically does not impart something unkosher, and therefore it's an added stringency. Yeah.
I have to go back to glass. I had been taught that although it was not traditional, one can theoretically kosher using Haggadah, aka using boiling water. Is that?
Yeah, for glass, can you use?
Because that's higher than the amount of heat it would typically get.
It's a different heat. It's a different. The problem is the rabbis talk about the doing the water thing. I have to get back to you on that.
Okay,
I'll get back to you on that. Look, Sfardim think that glass is perfectly fine no matter what. Also, in most cases, you're talking about drinking glasses. They never had anything hot in them. Never had any hot chametz, right? So you're really dealing with a lot of levels of prohibition that aren't really present. So glass plates are different. So I have to get back to you on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of the Echornim are also strict about glass doors on ovens or on microwaves. So
again, microwaves, the issue is, though, they don't really come in contact with the food. Right?
Yeah.
So microwaves, according to many opinions, are kosherable by cleaning them thoroughly, right? Clean them all the way out, and then boiling a cup of water inside the microwave, and the steam koshers the microwave. Don't use a chametz cup. Use a styrofoam cup or something like that. Some people think microwaves, because of the glass door, are not kosherable. That's up to you, what you would do. I think they're kosherable. The more challenging thing is the glass tray on the bottom. So you can just put a couple layers of saran wrap, not foil, because you'll explode. Wash it thoroughly, wrap it with saran wrap, and I think you're okay. But again, you will hear other opinions that don't like microwaves for Pesach. Yeah.
Just want to caution people to stop cleaning ovens. I know of a rabbi last year who was cleaning his house, and he went outside to play with his kids, set his oven on stop cleaning, and then the oven blew up in his house.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, so you know? Just be careful.
Because usually the story is people set their house on fire when they're blowtorching things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, two related questions. So if I'm thinking about accidents, if somebody accidentally brings something to a Seder that has chametz in it, first of all, does it negate the rest of the food on the table? And then second of all, what do you do if you accidentally eat it?
If you accidentally eat it, there's not much you can do.
There's no
you don't have to purge. You can do tshuva. Right?
No, I'm serious.
Yeah, I'm saying this. In terms of if it's hot chametz that came into contact with your other food, that sounds very unlikely to me, right? I'm not clear what someone could bring that would really be chametz.
It's hot.
They're bringing dinner rolls,
cupcakes.
So I think once it comes in, I think you'll be able to identify. Hey, that's a cupcake. I probably can't serve that.
Or people have thickened the gravy for the brisket with flour, and so then I'm oh.
Yeah, that would be a major problem.
So it doesn't negate the rest of the food on the table.
No.
But still.
But if the silverware that you put into it, if it's hot, would be a problem.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that would be complicated. Yeah. Dishwashers. Dishwashers are complicated. They're different opinions. You've got everything from they're not kosherable at all to you just run the cycle once. The most common thing I've seen for people who want to use them is they actually they dip the racks, they kosher the racks, they go to one of those places with the big cauldron. First, they clean it very thoroughly. You kosher the racks, you run it once through without the racks in there, and then you're good to go. If you want to be more stringent, the other thing you could do is you could put some dish soap on the bottom before you run it. So even from the very beginning when water comes in, the water is already soapy. And soapy water won't transmit flavor. The one thing I can tell you positively is you can eat comfortably in somebody's home who uses their dishwasher on Pesach. Whether you personally will do it, it's not making anything treif for you not to consume. So other than that, it's up to you, but those are the different strategies people use. Yeah?
Is silicone kosher?
I don't know. I guess if it's a plastic. Let's talk about sinks and countertops briefly. Oh, no, I'm sorry. First we have to do the, what do you call the top of the oven, the burners?
Right.
Okay. Right. So I knew that word. I couldn't think of the English word. So what you do with those, you have to clean the burner thoroughly, right, and clean the stovetop very thoroughly. The stovetop, by the way, is where the actual chametz exists, because you have definitely spilled pasta noodles or other things on that stovetop when you've cooked. So you clean that really thoroughly, okay? You clean the burners thoroughly. Don't use them for 24 hours. Then you turn the burners, you just turn everything on high for 15, 20 minutes, and it's kosher. You will find some folks will still cover the stovetop with foil, and some people might even cover the burners with foil. I don't think that's necessary. You will also find people who buy a separate set of burners, which is not so outrageously expensive for Pesach. Plug in, you just hook them up to your gas, and they work. So you'll find all things. Yeah.
Is that the same way that you would kosher a stovetop in a general situation?
Yes.
Clean it, wait 24 hours.
High.
For 15 minutes.
Correct. Same thing. Okay, sinks. Yeah.
So 15 to 20 minutes on high?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you can't just clean off your stove. Not the burner. Clean off your stove top, then do put boiling water on it.
You could. I think that would do a lot of harm. I wouldn't do that because I think that would ruin your burners. In theory, you could, but don't splash boiling water around. And it can really, I think it could damage your oven. I think the water could then, especially these are electric ovens, I think it could do a lot of damage.
Okay. I'm telling you that my husband did that, okay, when I was going to have 36 people for Seder, and it was bad. Don't pour the it almost got divorced.
Let's just say somebody didn't get to come to the Seder that year.
Don't do what I did one year when I was I had a son in yeshiva, and he was very harif. And I was kashering my hob, and I read somewhere you had to cover the hob in silver foil. So I put the heat burners onto high, covered the hob with silver foil and the whole of my oven.
The hob is the
The hob is the stovetop.
Of the stovetop.
I had like a range oven. I had a hob with another.
My recommendation.
And the whole thing melted.
Clean it thoroughly. Cover with foil.
Do those round things? You also have to. You give to the vat people.
Yes.
The vats.
The metal.
You should clean and. But remember. Once you clean them, some people will cover them with foil. In principle, because they're exposed to the highest heat, they're kosher. I will tell you, though, many people will buy different ones for Pesach or cover them with foil. It's your call. People have their little stringencies. The stovetop really should be covered with foil because there, actually, you do have a problem because it's had hot pasta on it that fell on it. If you're a Pesach, you put your hot Pesach spoon, wet spoon on it, you do have a potential for transfer, so that I would say really should be covered with foil. Yeah.
Not that it's totally applicable here, because I feel like everyone has gas stoves.
No, I have electric.
You're so fancy.
Electric, same thing. Turn it on high. Once it glows red, you're done.
Okay.
The thing that you should not ask me, because I haven't worked out yet, are those really fancy glass tops. I know someone's figured something out. I don't know what they figured out. Luckily, I don't have them. If that's a question for you, you know what, guys, I'm talking about? These super fancy, like it's like this special glass that heats up in different spots. It's like a space. I don't know what they do. I think I read something, the Star K online said something about it. Obviously, they figure out something, but I don't know what it is. But electric burners, gas burners, very easily done. Sinks, okay? The problem with sinks, of course, is it's had hot chametz in them. So in principle, if you put a hot Pesach dish that's got liquid on the side in the sink, you have a potential for transfer. So what do we do? Koshering sinks is very, very easy. You simply have to wash the sink thoroughly. Once again, don't use it for 24 hours, and then pour boiling water on the sink. Preferably, you can do it. The boiling water should come from a hot heat source. The easiest thing to do is to use one of those electric kumkums and boil water, or you can fill up an urn, right? And then you fill up the urn, and when it's boiling, unplug it, and then open the spigot and just cover the sink. Ideally, a direct stream should hit every part of the sink. Well, right, you could do that also and pour it up.
Metal
sinks. Porcelain sinks are not kosherable. You'd have to line them or use bins. Sorry. You will find people, by the way, who, in addition to koshering their sink, will line it as well. I will warn you, if you line your sink with foil, which I've seen people do, that foil gets disgusting within about 8 hours of use. Because the foil has like little crinkles in it, and food gets trapped. It's your call. Yeah.
If you the percolator you're using to pour the water onto the sink,
yeah,
it doesn't need to be kosher for Pesach, does it?
It's probably never not been kosher for Pesach. But in principle, I guess you'd want to use one that's never been used for that was kosher for Pesach.
But if you've only ever used water,
presumably then it's not. If you would use it on Pesach, you can use it to kosher for Pesach. How's that? Yeah.
Right, like a tea kettle, would that be?
So people go back and forth. In principle, they would. My urn actually is not, because we actually heat food on Shabbat on top of the urn. Right? It's a handy place to warm something up. So mine would not be, but
if you make tea in the kettle, then
I don't know if the tea was chametz, though. It's one of those things, in all likelihood, it's not. On the other hand, it's like 35 shekel for one of those things. So a lot of people just buy one for Pesach, and that's it.
Can you make a comment about the sink drain?
The sink drain, in principle, is washed and kosherable the same way the sink is.
It has a rubber gasket. Is that okay or not? Okay. I tend to buy a new one.
Again, you're probably not. So a lot of people do buy new ones. You're not really eating off of it. And then rubber is back to the same earlier question.
Okay. Right.
Many people have the practice of buying a new drain. That's true. By the way, you should also, as best you can, pour hot water on the faucet. But that's also a stringency. Countertops. Countertops.
Fun.
Countertops made of wood or stone are all kosherable, which means the same thing you do with your sink, You wash your countertop thoroughly. Don't put anything hot on. Don't use it for 24 hours. Boiling water on it, and you're good to go. Countertops made from what's called Evan Kesar here in Israel. What is the term?
Caesar
stone. That should be the, thank you. That's just the translation. There you go. Made from Caesar stone are technically not kosherable. If something is not kosherable, then you ideally cover it for Pesach. And you can cover it with anything you want. You could use foil. You could use that. So clean it thoroughly and then cover it with that. They make like that sticky stuff. It's not so pleasant to work with. Also, it gets kind of gross on it. A practical thing is you can also get trivets. So your stuff is never on that paper stuff that people, that liner that people put down. Some people actually order cut like these Pyrex covers that they use for Pesach. You do not need to kosher and cover. Even though many people will, that is not necessary. You can do either or. Many people, though, will do both. I'm just warning you. Yeah.
What about the, linoleum kind of, fake, not granite, but this, what is on the table?
I'd have to look. I don't think, my impression is that may not be kosherable, but I don't know.
You can't boil it.
Right.
You can. No, but I don't think it's
kosherable, but I'd have to check.
So we have them.
Oh. They cover it.
Yeah, we covered that for years.
Yeah.
What if you got some? So you got a stone countertop, but it's got some cracks in it.
Clean the cracks.
But yeah, it's still okay just to pour water.
Well, yeah, because the boiling water is going to kosher whatever's in the crack, just like it'll kosher the surface. Just make sure you pour water over it. Remember, I just want to make something clear to you. You realize that the transfer from your countertop is still pretty unlikely, right? Because what would have to happen is, you'd have to have a countertop that had hot chametz land here, and then a hot pot with boiling liquid placed exactly on that spot. It's not like your countertop is a big loaf of bread. Okay? Now, there are reasons that we kosher and do these things, but again, if somebody did not kosher their countertop, I think you could still eat their food. Okay? I'm quite confident of that. These are all the precautions that we take. Yeah?
For the kitchen table and the drawers where you keep kaolin and things, you can just clean it with soap and water.
Yeah. The table, like my wife always insisted on putting Pesach tablecloths on the table. In theory, you could clean it very well, because again, nothing hot is going directly on there. But a lot of people will put a tablecloth down. Look, there's a famous story, this famous Rav, whose wife used to sand the tabletop before Pesach, and when the mother-in-law would come, she would still hold the plate in her hand because she didn't trust it. You could pour boiling water. It's just for most kitchen tables, it's not great for the table. But yes, if it's a wood table, you could kosher it. Absolutely. Clean it. Same rules would apply. You can kosher it. I think it's just easier to cover it, to be honest with you. But if you want to kosher it, you can.
So in Israel, it's only Evan Kesar? There are no other covers?
I don't want to say for sure. I don't know all the materials that are out there. I don't remember exactly. I know that stone is fine, and wood is fine. The other stuff I have to check. Yeah. Yeah, so you clean it out the best you can. If you really think you can't clean it, then cover it or cover that spot. Or put a trivet down. You don't put things on that spot. Yeah.
Refrigerators, you just clean them out, no foil.
Refrigerators, don't line your refrigerator because the air won't flow and you'll break your fridge. Okay? Plus, it's all cold in there. Nothing is trafe in your refrigerator. Clean your refrigerator because you should clean your refrigerator. What's the matter with you people? Not clean your refrigerator, but keep in mind your vegetable bin is not chametz, your fruit bin is not chametz. There's really almost no chametz in there, but clean it out. There is, however, at least for me, a lot of chametz in the freezer. The freezer has to be cleaned out well. You got to get all the crumbs out of there. No boiling water in the fridge or in the freezer. You will break something, and it's unnecessary. There's no heat transfer happening in your fridge or in your freezer, but you do have to clean them. And if you have an old freezer, you probably have to thaw it out first. They still make those?
No.
Those are gone?
Yeah.
So, but clean them well, because my freezer, for example, that's where all of our bread is. That's like the one place in the kitchen that actually needs it. Now, let's talk about basic cleaning for a minute. The only part of your house that needs to be removed of all crumbs is the kitchen. The crumbs in your couch, unless you're really a weird person, you're not going to eat them. And they do not they're not considered Olim Chametz San Pesach. Having said that, Rachel Dingman, you should vacuum the crumbs out of your couch. That's gross. Okay? But your drapes, your windows, your closets are not chametz. The only place you have to clean halachically is a place where chametz has been. Okay? So if you eat in your bedroom, as some people do, you should clean up your bedroom. You should make sure that, first of all, don't eat in your bedroom. But secondly, you know, any place where there's food, you should clean out. But the only place that really requires serious attention is the kitchen. So for people who are cleaning for days and days on end, if you want to do spring cleaning, that's great. It's not halachically required. The kitchen you should do, because we have crumbs in our kitchen. I should also mention like toaster ovens are not considered kashable for Pesach. So you have to clean them to remove the crumbs, but you can't really kasher them and use them for Pesach. Yeah.
Maybe I was outside the microwave.
We discussed it. In my opinion, they're kosherable. Clean them thoroughly inside and out. Boil a cup of water in there. And then you should double wrap with saran wrap the glass tray that's in there. I have to get back to you about koshering glass with a galah. Yeah.
Like, this kind of toaster is not okay, but like this kind of toaster.
None of them. They're too small.
What?
Yeah.
What
are
you
going to
toast
it with? Mozzarella pizza. Yeah. Guess I'll just use my oven.
Use your oven.
We don't even have one of those. I'm upset. Yeah.
Okay. Medicines. Okay. Medicines are not chametz. And even if, which they don't even use anymore, even if they use a binding agent for the pills, you're swallowing the pills, you're not chewing them, you're not eating them for food, the binding agent tastes terrible. With Moshe Feinstein, Paskin, there's no need for them to be kosher for Pesach. However, you will have people out there who will insist that the medicines not have any chametz in them. It's your call. The one thing I will beg and plead, if you are taking a medicine because you need it, don't mess around and take the medicine. The sin is on me if there is one. If you're talking about vitamins or other things, that might be a different discussion, but usually you can look online and find out, because now because of celiacs, anything that's a wheat binding agent, they tell you. And if it's a kidney oat binding agent, I don't think you should worry about it. That's all I have to say about medicines. Take your medicine. Yeah.
What about cosmetics, like deodorant, perfume, that sort of thing?
Again, you will find people who insist that stuff be kosher for Pesach because of this strange sugya about sicha kashtia, that something you anoint yourself with is like drinking from it. I don't think any of that stuff, soaps or anything of that stuff, is even edible. I don't think it's food. I don't think there's any chametz in it. You will find dishwashing liquid and things like that here that say kosher for Pesach. My guess is they simply run a line and they add this symbol onto it. But, you know, when someone came to Rabbi Yosef and asked if their soap was kosher for Pesach, he took out a pen and wrote a P on it. Now it's fine. Up to you. But again, I'm not making fun. If people have these stringencies, you can be as stringent as you want. I don't think laundry detergent or things like that. The one thing that is an issue is pet food. Pet food is a problem if it's chametz, because you can't own it or feed it to your pets. So the supermarkets here will stock kosher LePesach pet food. Fish are often a problem. We used to have to give our fish bloodworms on Pesach because the fish food was all chametz. Disgusting but cool. They come in these little frozen bricks. So pet food is an issue that you have to look into. Other than that, I think we covered. Any last remaining questions? I think we did it.
Roommates.
Your roommate's chametz is not yours in terms of violating prohibition of owning chametz on Pesach. The problem is the kitchen. And if they are actually bringing chametz into your kitchen, you're going to have a real problem, because the oven, the burners, it's going to be a serious challenge. I would suggest you have a conversation.
You have a
we have a third roommate. So, like, we've already discussed this, and we're the ones who will be doing all of the cleaning because he.
I understand.
We've actually hired a chômeur to stand at the door for
Pesach.
But if they want to eat bread in their room, that's not a halachic problem for you. But the kitchen would be a major challenge, I have to admit. That would be tough to work around. Yeah.
In terms of roommates, like, we've talked about in our house, that just, like, putting all of the, like, good, not wanting to throw out hummus together and selling it together as, like, a house.
You can do that. If it's all shared owned, you can all sell it. Yeah, you can all sell it together. By the way, if you want to kosher your roommate for Pesach, you can either dip them in boiling water, put them in the oven when you kosher your oven, or soak them in water and change the water every 24 hours. All of those will work. By the way, best question ever, how do you kosher your fillings for Pesach?
Drink tea.
One person said their custom is to drink water as hot as they can stand it before Pesach to kosher the fillings. I simply use a little blowtorch in there. It hurts the crown. The crown's painful.
What if
you
just face in one of
those bags?
Could do that too. Oh, there are things about koshering dentures. Don't worry, that's been thought of. Our dentures made of kosher material. You need a separate set for Pesach. Don't worry, that's actually a legitimate question. Yeah, look, it's a legitimate question, right? Because, you know, but I think the point is we generally say that the food that's in your mouth is not really hot enough to create the transfer. Yeah.
See, that is, I have a night guard, actually, like a plastic night guard. If you put it in hot water, it does get ruined.
You don't have to kosher your night guard.
So I think we should just maybe not.
You don't have to kosher your night guard. You're not eating with it. You're not cooking with it. You don't use it as a spoon when you eat your own meal. I think you're okay. Okay, any other urgent questions? I have to get back to you on the glass, which I will later today. Hey, I think we did it.
Wow.
Kol hakavod, everyone. The last thing to say is everything I've said, community standards are different. People have different customs. So I would say resolve for yourself what you're going to do. Don't expect other people, no matter how logical it sounds to you, don't expect other people necessarily to follow your logic or your thinking. Try to be respectful. Pesach is not, it's not worth ruining relationships over. That's my last piece of advice to you.
Thank you.
Chag Sameach, everybody. Have a wonderful, meaningful chag.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.